5 p.m.
The happiest of happy hours.
That's exactly right. Friday at 5 p.m. Does it get better?
It just doesn't get better than this.
Especially for us. Time for American Hit Radio here at WHPC. Woo. 90.3 FM. Tom Ryan here. Heidi Morales Ryan as well. The both of us together, of course, as we always are. On Wednesdays and Fridays from 5 until 6. On Fridays, this is what we call How Music Changed. We change our show's format a little bit. And we are in the midst of covering the history of the Rolling Stones in depth. We're taking a good look at a significant amount of their history. This is actually show number 36, dedicated to the Stones. 36 weeks of Rolling Stones. 36
Ron's
hours.
Loving it.
It's getting better and better, baby. Well, this is about as good as it does get with today's show, to be honest, because we're covering the album Some Girls, as it was released in 1978. It is it was an instant hit for the band, a huge success on just about every level. It went to number one in the United States and quickly became the best-selling album in the band's career.
How about that?
Quite good. Commercially and artistically, the album was an unqualified success. The critics loved it. The public loved it. And it's really kind of funny to think that the whole thing really came about almost at a time when the Stones were really having a hard time even rehearsing because Keith was constantly having to fly to Canada to deal with his court issues. He wasn't able to write much with Mick. As usual, the Stones are in a total mess. I mean, since the whole career, this is one thing I'm learning from doing this show, is the Stones really
They bounced from mess to mess.
Really, it was always a disaster around what was happening around them. And add to that the fact that punk just hit, and one of the main targets of the punks was the Rolling Stones, because the Rolling Stones looked like they were getting old and tired. Albums like Black and Blue weren't really cutting it for the younger kids. And they said, you know what, you're dinosaurs. You know, you're obsolete. Get out of the way. And all of a sudden, you know, now the Stones at number one with an album called Some Girls, the punks were eating the Stones' dust. It's just you know, punk failed to catch on with the general public, and it eventually kind of faded out of the mainstream.
Radio failed to pick it up, but
right.
That's my argument.
And just not many people were buying the records. It just wasn't really that popular of a genre. Even like when it morphed into new wave, it was still a little bit on the outside. That's where all this classic rock stuff began to get come back to life again. It was crazy. But the Stones basically beat the punk at their own game by starting to play songs that sounded like they were punks. So the Stones could now finally rightly claim that they were the best rock and roll band in the world. Definitely the most popular. And a lot of this came about, you know, basically on songs that were being written by Mick Jagger, as I said, because Keith wasn't able to do much. So today, let's start with side two. And this is a song you've heard 1,000 times. My favorite thing about the song Faraway Eyes is the way Mick Jagger takes his British accent, adds a touch of Cockney, and then adds a Southern slang to it. And what comes out is this amazingly weird soup of an accent as he basically cops his way through a fairly tongue-in-cheek idea of what it's like to be, I guess, a rural American. Here's Faraway Eyes.
Sunday morning through Bakersfield, listening to gospel music on the colored radio station, and the preacher said, you know, you always have the Lord by your side. And I was so pleased to be informed of this that I ran 20 red lights in his honor. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. I had an arrangement to meet a girl, and I was kind of late. And I thought by the time I got there, she'd be off with the nearest truck driver she could find. Much to my surprise, there she was, sitting in the corner, a little blear. the girl with faraway eyes. Well,
Man.
It's a good image of him mailing off for a prayer on the radio. It's cute.
It was so fun lyrically when that came out in 78. There was just, it got played all the time, and it was always fun to hear it because you could just see Mick Jagger, like, you know, basically taking Americans down a step a little bit in a way, but it was in a funny way. And that song got so much airplay. It wasn't a single. It wasn't a hit single. I think it was a B-side on one of the singles. But boy, did it get a lot of airplay. Keith talks a little bit about the album, of course, in his book, Life, and what he thought about, you know, about basically setting it up. I'll read an excerpt here. What a lot of Some Girls was down to was this little green box I used, this MXR pedal, a reverb echo. For most of the songs on there, I'm using that, and it elevated the band. And it gave it a different sound. In a way, it came down to a little bit of technology. It was kind of like Satisfaction, a little box. On Some Girls, I just found a way of making that thing work, at least through all of the fast songs. And Charlie was on with it, and Bill Wyman too, I've got to say. There was a certain sense of renewal. A lot of it was, we've got to outpunk the punks. Because they can't play, and we can. All they can do is be punks. Yes, that might have been a certain thorn in the side. The Johnny Rottens, these kids. I love every band that comes along. That's why I'm here, to encourage guys to play and get bands together. But when they're not playing anything, they're just spitting on people. Now, come on, we can do better than that. There was also an extra urgency because of this grim prospect of the trial. And also because after all the palaver, the bust, the noise, the cleaning up, I needed to prove that there was something behind all this, some purpose to this kind of suffering. Here's a good example of what Keith's talking about as far as basically answering the punks and also that guitar sound that he's talking about. If these aren't punk lyrics, I don't know what punk lyrics are. If you're talking about doing drugs on the White House lawn with the president, here's Respectable.
Yeah.
the Stones' best rockers there. Respectable, of course.
I wonder what the inspiration there was.
Really? Great lyrics by Mick. I mean, Mick was really on top of his game around this point in time writing. And I'll tell you, he was definitely not writing about Keith. Because Keith was definitely just down. In fact, he spends a lot of time in his book, in this stage of time, talking about heroin use and about how it affected his life. Here's a little excerpt regarding that, including his relationship with Mick. I can be as big-headed as Mick and flighty and everything, but you can't do that when you're a junkie. There are certain realities that come into play that really keep your feet in the gutter, even lower than you need to be, not even on the sidewalk, in the gutter. And obviously, that was the period when Mick and I went off almost perfect 180s. He had no time for me in my supposedly stupid state. Keith tells a story in here. It's almost a how-to use heroin in the book. It's so explicit in some places that you even question whether or not it's like if he's being intelligent by even writing this down because it's so weird. But I want to read some excerpts about it because it's so incredibly. It's actually amusing now that you know that he survived it and how he came off of it. This is how he talked about it and what he was going through around this time, especially in New York City. Everything revolved around the stuff. Nothing could be done or organized without first organizing the next fix. It got more and more dire. Elaborate arrangements had to be made, some of them more comic than others. I had a man who would call up when I was going from London to New York. I would stay at the Plaza Hotel. James, this sweet young Chinese man, would meet me in the suite, the big one preferably, and I'd hand him the cash, and he'd give me what I needed. And it was always very polite. Give my regards to your father. So, you know, when I traveled, I would wear a hat and use a needle to fix a little feather to the hat band. So it was just a hat pin. I would put the trilby with the red, green, and gold feather in the hat bag. Okay, but now I need the syringe. My trick was, I'd order a cup of coffee because I needed a spoon for cooking up. Then I'd go down to FAO Schwartz, the toy shop right across Fifth Avenue from the plaza. And if you went to the third floor, you could buy a doctor and nurse play set, a little plastic box with a red cross on it. That had the barrel and the syringe that fitted the needle that I'd brought. I'd go around and say, I'll have three teddy bears, I'll have that remote control car. Oh, and give me two doctor and nurse kits. My niece, you know, she's really into that. Must encourage her. So it was out of control. Now, at the same time, of course, Keith is awaiting the outcome of his trial. He could be put away for as much as 20 years. And he's constantly having to fly to Canada. It's eating up so much of his time. And he had one song from the album that was exclusively his that he sang. And it really was about what he was facing. This song is really about Keith thinking about possibly facing jail time, about basically hoping that they'll let him walk.
Oh, boy.
Before they make him run. Here's that track.
Thank you. That's Keith's track from the album Some Girls.
That actually was released as a single in a slightly different mix. It was on something like the Bob Clearmountain mix, I think is what it was. But I remember that I think it came out credited to Keith as opposed to the Rolling Stones, which was an odd thing. Because this album was just so full of potential hits. And that was a weird choice. But I think that the song was so poignant for Keith that they decided that that would be a good idea for him to basically put that out. I remember it came with the picture sleeve on the 45 with a close-up picture of just Keith's face. And the B-side had him doing Chuck Berry's Run, Rudolph, Run on the single. Anyway, the thing that was attracting a lot of attention with this album I didn't talk about yet at all was the packaging. As far as covers go, this was a bit of a doozy. It was a die-cut sleeve, which means that it had holes punched in the front cover and the back cover so that when you slid the album in and out, you'd see hole. You know, basically it would just be a hole, but then when you slid the album back in, faces would appear where these cuts were. And what they did was, first of all, besides having all of the Rolling Stones done up in this really crazy overdone drag with crazy wigs and lipstick and everything else, they filled up the other slots with celebrities, also with their faces painted in the same way, like some really crazy garish drag-like makeup. And like Lucille Ball was on it, Farrah Fawcett, Liza Minnelli, and Raquel Welch, Marilyn Monroe.
Let me guess, they didn't get the proper releases.
Right, they didn't bother at all. It's amazing that they had the audacity to put that out and not even, you know, cleared with anybody. So naturally, there, you know, lawsuits resulted, not from everybody, but from a few people. And they realized that they just have to basically chuck the cover entirely. So they had to. What they did is they took off all of the celebrities, except for one shot of George Harrison. They figured that he would never complain. They took everybody else off, and they covered. And to make it look really punk-like, it just said, "Pardon our appearance, cover under construction or under reconstruction." And they just dropped that in wherever there was somebody else's picture. To this day, that's the way the cover looks. They never changed it back. So once it went under reconstruction, that's it stayed like that.
That's it.
The original cover is fairly valuable. I do have it. I mean, a lot of them went out. It's not like it's super rare because it was out and it was selling well. And, you know, a lot of people bought the album early. I did. So I had that original cover. And that's just the way it is.
Lucky me.
Now, another thing that's interesting about the album is that it had three hit singles on it. The opening track on side one, Miss You, of course, was the biggest hit. But all the other songs on the rest of the album were the album tracks until they saved the two hit singles for the very last two songs on the album, which is an unusual way to lay out an album. I don't think I can think of another example of an album where they basically waited for the last two tracks to put the other two big hit songs. Here's one of them. Here's Beast of Burden.
Well, Miss You went to number one on the singles charts. Beast of Burden didn't do so badly, considering that it was the second single from an album. Second singles traditionally do much worse than a first single on a release for an album for a simple reason.
Well, this was bound for great things.
Well, you know what it is? It's like the first single usually precedes the album, so people will buy it
right.
in droves, and then because it's a way, it's introducing the album. Then the album comes out, you own it, so if you release the next single from the album, the audience is seriously diminished because they already bought the album.
Right.
And so that's the situation here. But Beast of Burden, nevertheless, managed to reach number eight on the singles charts.
How about that?
Now, the thing, the other single that was released from the album is the next track, Shattered, which is so much. You know, we talked last week about how the album was such a New York-centric album. and in so many ways, it's like you can't hear this album without basically seeing the New York City of 1978 in your
grungy.
Mind's eye. Yeah, the whole grungy, dirty end of it. First of all, obviously, the illusions of Miss You being a disco track, New York was obviously the center of the whole disco scene. Studio 54 and everything else was happening right there in New York City.
Break out your Fiorucci jeans, baby.
Exactly right. And in fact, Mick had met Liza Minnelli at Studio 54 when he had to like apologize to her about the cover. Of the album. That's one of the incidents that had been happening around that time. But New York comes up on the album in other ways. Like, okay, the punk thing, obviously, too, because New York was one of the major cities for the entire punk movement and what was happening there. But they mention it explicitly on a number of songs, but none more so than Shattered. Shattered is simply about New York. Every single word of the song is about how the city had basically crumbled, and it looked like it was the end, like the end days of Rome for a while in 1978. It was bad, really bad. And there's really hardly a word in this song that is not true for what New York was like in 1978. Here's one of the best punk songs ever written by the Rolling Stones, maybe by anybody. Here's Shattered.
My love is never true.
smoking, man. I don't know. I could hear that song 1,000 times. I probably have heard it 1,000 times. It's
at least
really hard to get tired of that because it's not really structurally built around anything except for Mick Jagger's almost freeform rant on that. It's brilliant. Meanwhile, you know, as I said, you know, Keith's going through his trial thing. Let's cover that right now with what was going on because it's so integral to these times and what was going on. I'm going to read excerpts here from his book, Life. My trial was finally heard in Toronto in October 1978. We knew it might sink us all. But in the face of it, some of us were looking on the bright side. I don't think it's going to be as bad as that, said Mick. You've got to say if the worst happens and Keith gets put in an open prison with Mrs. Trudeau for life, then I'm still going to go on the road. Maybe we could play a tour of Canadian prisons.
Johnny Cash.
The longer the process went on, the clearer it was that the Canadian government wanted to wriggle out of it. The Mounties and their allies were thinking, oh, great, wonderful job. We've delivered him to the Canadian government with a hook in his mouth. And the Trudeaus were thinking, uh-uh, pal, this is the last thing we need. There were 500 to 600 people outside every time I turned up in court, chanting, free Keith, free Keith. Nils Lofgren wrote a song around this time, by the way, called Keith Don't Go.
Aww.
It was popular. And we knew that the enemy camp, if you want to call the Canadian government at the time the enemy, our persecutors, were unsure of their footing, whereas I didn't mind. I figured the harder they hit me, the easier I would get out. The Mounties, or at least the prosecution, didn't want to wriggle out at all. They knew I wasn't trafficking, but they wanted to railroad it through a jury to get a long and historic jail sentence. There, they made a mistake. Look at Keith Richards. He's not selling drugs. He's got all the money he needs.
Right.
The allegation of trafficking just to get a stiff sentence is absurd. He's a hopeless addict. He has a medical problem. My lawyers wrote a report that showed that according to all legal precedent and local case histories, if I weren't Keith Richards, I would probably have gotten no more than a suspended sentence. Only at the last minute did they change the trafficking charge to possession, adding a cocaine charge. But this shift weakened and exposed them. Exposed more about the Canadian government than anything to do with, oh, guess what? Keith Richards is on smack. What else is new? The idea of the prime minister's wife buzzing around the hotel trying to get laid was another thing. So one thing overwhelmed the other, so to speak. I certainly felt that whatever the charge was, I was definitely in way above my head or below it, any way you look at it. Who knows what really goes on? It's called politics. It's one of the scrubbiest games in town. So we knew it was dead in the water. Now it was, how long will it take for them to get me out of here? They walked themselves into it. Now they don't want to know about it. And how will they find their way out of it? We were waiting to watch the Canadian government melt. The Canadian people were the ones that got me off the hook. But really, the mastery of it was coordinating the faux pas of Margaret Trudeau. If they had hit me hard and quick, they probably could have got me just for importing. But when it came to court, clearly the new judge had said, get this thing off the hook. We don't want any more to do with this. It's causing us more embarrassment and money than it's worth. On the day of reckoning, I arrived in court, this courtroom that had the air of England in the 1950s with a portrait of the Queen hanging strangely on the wall.
Lovely.
The actor, Dan Aykroyd, who I'd met when we did Saturday Night Live just before this, was on standby as a Canadian and character witness. The producer of the show, its Canadian founder, who still produces it, Lorne Michaels, spoke in court about my role as a slinger of hash in the great cultural kitchen. He did a very elegant job of it. The verdict was guilty. But the judge concluded, I will not incarcerate him for addiction and wealth. He must be freed, said the judge, to get on with his treatment with the condition. He will perform a concert for the blind. Very intelligent, I thought, the most Solomon-like judgment that had been handed down in many a year. And this was to do with a blind girl who had followed the Stones everywhere on the road. Rita, my blind angel. Despite her blindness, she hitchhiked to our shows. The chick was absolutely fearless. I'd heard about her backstage, and the idea of her thumbing in the darkness was too much for me. I hooked her up with the truck drivers, made sure she got a safe lift, and made sure she got fed. And when I was busted, she actually found her way to the judge's house and told him this story.
And this is how he arrived at the Concert for the Blind.
That's sweet.
The love and devotion of people like Rita is something that still amazes me. So, aha, a way was found. And for the band, everything was turning to gold. Somewhat rare Stones track there. Everything is turning to gold. That was actually a
That
B-side.
Must have been after the they won the court case.
Actually, I can't say when it was written, but I definitely set it up that way.
Yeah.
In my story.
Yes.
But that was the B-side of one of the 45s, though, that came out from Some Girls album. Last week, we played some of the rarities as well. And I think we'd have some fun with the time that's remaining. There's a couple more that I think are really interesting, especially from a New Yorker's point of view. Here on Long Island as well. So let's play some of these tracks that have gone pretty much completely unheard until the super deluxe expanded edition of the album was released. Here's a track called Do You Think I Really Care?
she wears.
You can tell that the track is not quite finished as far as the songwriting goes, but it's still interesting. You know, it's a good. It sounds like it could have, if they worked on it a little bit more, it might have been a great track. You know, it's very good. And I love, you know, that little Long Island Expressway reference there. I figured I had to play that for the Long Island in me and for our listeners.
Aww.
Another thing I should mention, last week we were talking about who was playing on the piano on some of the bonus tracks. And I had mentioned that I thought it might have been Ian McClagan, who had come along to a lot of the sessions with Ronnie Wood. I had since found out that it was not the case, actually. It was a different Ian. It was Ian Stewart, Stewie, the keyboardist that was pretty much playing with the Stones since they were teenagers, who's playing all those
very
piano
cool.
bits. Yeah. Let's play one more track from these sessions before we move on. This is another one that caught my fancy that I thought was probably good enough for to be an album release, actually. This is called No Spare Parts.
At the wheel of my car, and I'm coming on home to you. Yeah. Lonely hearts, they're not made to break. I got no spare parts, got no oil to change. Honey, I ain't accustomed to lace. If I want something bad enough, I always find a way. If I want something bad enough, I always find a way to get through. I take the 10 to Fiend, he's been to somebody afternoon. Some shutter and Benson and a bite at the greasy spoon. Took the turn off night, I should have stayed on the end to stay. I was lost in the real, my map was kinda out. All the lights of Marfa, I guess it was a scenic route. But when I had to change a tie, I'm glad I wore my western boots. Lonely hearts, they're not made to break. I got no spare parts, got no shining in my eyes. We
with the air combusted, the windshield full of flies. And just a few hours, you're gonna fall in my loving arms. I've been so hot to see you. Something bad enough, I always find a way to get a baby. If I want something bad enough, I always find a way to get through. If I want something bad enough, I always find a way to get through. Yeah. Lonely heart, then I made to break. I've got no heart to change.
Just one example of the type of tracks that the Stones had lying around that went completely unused, and which is especially unusual because with their upcoming albums, a lot of them were nothing more than compilations of stuff that was lying around. Albums like Tattoo You were just thrown together bits of stuff that they didn't use from these sessions.
They should have consulted you.
Right? Well, they had songs like Start Me Up, for example, which was recorded in these sessions as well.
Right.
That they just put in the can. So there's a great example of the type of thing that was basically sitting on waiting to be released. But of course, when it was, it became a hit. This is an instance of it never even getting out, a song like that.
Right.
Well, we just about used up our hour. What I want to do is to fill up the rest of the time. We played, of course, the album version of the first hit, Miss You. But it's worth mentioning, and probably playing some of it anyway, that around this time, something had changed in the way that music was being marketed. Because of the disco scene and what was happening, a lot of artists in the disco market were releasing these 12-inch records with dance mixes on them.
Right, the remix.
Right, or sometimes that was really just the way it came out, that it would be an 8-minute-long track, you know, basically for dancing. And it was an unusual thing. Rock and roll artists weren't really doing it.
Right.
But the Stones were one of the first to do exactly that. They released Miss You on a 12-inch record, and it became hugely successful. There were a zillion copies of this thing all over the place. And of course, and it wasn't just a different mix. It was a different recording of the track because it had all these sections that didn't exist on the album part. And it was almost 9 minutes in length. So we'll leave you with that version of that song, and we'll return next week as we cover the album Emotional Rescue. Take care, everybody. Have a good one.
Sleeping all alone. think I'm crazy. Stuffing on my feet, shuffling to the street, asking people, what's the matter with you, boy? Sometimes I wanna say to myself, sometimes I say,